want to give you a few thoughts about Amalek and Purim, and maybe tie it in a little bit with the Seder. First, speak about Amalek, things that I've mentioned in the past, but maybe in this room, but not for the same faces. What distinguished Amalek from all the other nations insofar that after Kriyas Yamsuf, after the splitting of the Red Sea, the world was afraid of us, the entire world, except for Amalek. We were like a boiling hot bath. Chazal say, Rashi brings down, that everybody was afraid to touch. And Amalek jumped in, and even though they were burned, they opened the floodgates for all our other enemies to realize that we are touchable and not untouchable. So why were they not afraid? They stupid, they were crazy, then we should have Rahmanis on them. Why were they the only nation that wasn't afraid? I've said in the past the following idea, which I have a little bit of a proof to, but it explains a lot of things, so that in itself seems to show that there's something to it. Up until Amalek, there were two camps in the world. There was those that followed Avraham Avinu, predominantly, who believed in one God, who was the heir, spiritual heir to Adam HaRishon and Noah, and the ones that he converted, his own family, the children of Yishmael, all of them believed in one God. And then there were idol worshippers. People believed in many gods, in all different kinds of powers that ran the world. Amalek introduced a third column, third philosophy, atheism, belief in nothing, not in idolatry and not in a belief in God. And the source for this, somewhat, is the following Medrash. The Medrash says, on the Pasuk in Mishle, Hakei lets the pesi yisorer. It's not exactly the wording of the sentence, but it's close to it. The Pasuk in Mishle says, if you hit the lets, the fool will wake up. So the Medrash comments, lets ze Amalek, upesi ze Yisro. When the Amalekim were hit, that awakened Yisro to come and join the Jewish people. As Rashi brings down the beginning of Parshas Yisro, Vayishma Yisro, what did Yisro hear? The splitting of the Red Sea and the Milchemes Amalek, and the fact that Amalek came to attack us. That's what aroused him to come and join the Jewish people. So you hit the lets, and the pesi, the fool, will wake up. So Reb Sadik Milublin explains why Yisro is called a pesi, a fool, and Amalek is called a letz, a scoffer. He said a letz is someone who believes in nothing, and a pesi is somebody who believes in everything. Yisro believed in everything. Every power in the world he investigated until he came to believe in one God. And Amalek believed in nothing, meaning they believe in no powers. They're atheists. So it seems from there that similar idea. And therefore, Amalek weren't afraid of Kriyas Yamsuf. All the other nations who were idol worshippers assumed that there was some intelligent power, whether it was God or not, whatever God they thought it may be, that favored the Jewish people and can do extremely miraculous, potent things to hurt their enemies and to help them. So they were afraid of us. But Amalek, who are atheists, didn't believe in any intelligent powers that rule the world or guide the world. And therefore they weren't afraid. What should they be afraid of? Blind chance? It was just a coincidence that it happened. And that's why Amalek is called Rashis and we're called Rashis. Rashis Goyim Amalek and Klal Yisrael are Rashis Tevuasa. Why? In my estimation, what it means is the following. It's like a tug of war. You have two teams on the ends of the rope, and everybody else is in the middle, right? You're trying to pull the middle to your side. We're on one end of the rope. We believe in one God. Amalek is on the other end of the rope. They believe in nothing. All the rest of the world is in the middle. They believe in idolatry. Amalek is trying to pull them from idolatry to atheism, and we're trying to pull them from idolatry to belief in one God. And that is the struggle, milchama, that goes on throughout the generations between us and Amalek. Who is going to influence the world? We or they? And the stronger we are, the weaker they are, the more doubts they have. And the weaker and the stronger they are, the weaker we are, the more doubts we have. If you wouldn't know, the fact that there's an Amalek in the world weakens our emunah. Because the tenacity and intensity of their kfira, of their total disbelief in anything, and their explanation of everything in the world as coming from blind, random forces, both the creation of the world just occurred, just evolved, and the evolution of the world and the workings of the world are attributed to blind economic, social, political forces, has to weaken our emunah, because we have another way of explaining what goes on besides God. If you wouldn't know there's another alternative to creation, your belief in creation would be a lot stronger. But because we know that there is another alternative, right? Secular evolution, and there are intelligent people who believe in it. It has to make us have doubts. Well, maybe there's something to it. Maybe these are people, everybody can't be wrong. So at least it puts doubts in our mind, yes.
Wouldn't it go the other way around also? It's because we are weak in emunah that they're able to...
Yeah, 100%. Both, 100%. When we are, and let me just elaborate on that point, because it's true. And therefore, whenever we are weak in our emunah, we give strength to Amalek and we are vulnerable to them. And when we weaken them, by strengthening ourselves, we are helping to destroy them, basically, if not completely and physically, but spiritually and quantitatively. And therefore, when were we first vulnerable to Amalek? When we had doubts whether God was with us. We needed water in the desert. We came to Moshe Rabbeinu, and we complained, and we said, is God with us or not? Hayesh Hashem bikirbeinu inayim. And the Mefarshim explained, what was the question? They saw the cloud of glory and the pillar of fire and they had all these things. What was the problem? What was the doubt? The question was, they thought maybe God is only around for miraculous things. But nature, God put the world like on a Shabbos clock and that's it. Right? Nature takes its own course. God doesn't get involved for the everyday things. For drinks of water, God's not there. Splitting seas, He's there. When we have doubts, if God is involved in every aspect of the world, every second, when we're in doubt, if nature is God's doing, then we are vulnerable to Amalek. We don't even believe that miracles are God's doing. So the stronger we are, the weaker they are, the weaker they are. And that's why in Gematria, Amalek is Sothik, doubt. Because that's what they can do. They can create doubts in our mind vis-a-vis God's presence and interaction with the world. That's why Chazal say, based on the following verse in the end of Parshas Bishalach, Ki yod al keis ko milchoma l'ashem ba'amolek midor dor. Yod al keis ko means, Rashi says, God lifted up His hand over His throne in an oath that He will wage war with Amalek from generation to generation, through us. And this war is, like we said, this struggle to bring the world to belief or to total atheism. So, in that sentence, the word for God's throne is contracted to case instead of kisei. And the word, the name of God is contracted to yud-kei instead of yud-kei vav-kei. Case ka, God's throne. But the throne is written without an aleph, and the name of God is written without the last two letters, Vav-Hei. So on that, Chazal comment, as long as Amalek is in the world, Ein HaKisei Shalem, the Ein HaShem Shalem. God's throne is not complete, and God's name is not complete. What does that mean? So there are tremendously deep ideas, I'm sure, but I'll tell you what I think it means simply. God's throne is a symbol to God's divine providence, His control and direction and guidance of the world in everything that happens. Everything is hashgacha. When you see a king sitting on his throne, you know that he's settled and he's in control of his kingdom. But what if you see an empty throne? Then maybe the king's been deposed. Maybe there is no king. And then maybe there's anarchy. Nobody's in control. When you take the Aleph away from Kisei, Aleph represents God, Echad, one. You take the Aleph off the Kisei, you're left with Kase. Kase means hidden. Then God's ways are very, very hidden. You can't see him anymore. So that's what Amalek does. They make it hard to see God as the one who's controlling the world, and they attribute everything to blind social, economic, political forces. And that's why God's name isn't complete. God's name, Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, means Hoya Hove Yihya. Past, present, future, God transcends time. Okay? And he basically brought everything into existence, past, present, and future. If you take the first two letters of God's name, Yud and Hey, those are the letters that make up the words Hoya and Yihya, past and future. They're all just Yuds and Heys, duplicated, used more than once. But you can't make Vav Hove present from that. The last two letters of God's name, Vav He, are the letters that comprise Hove, the present. The meaning, therefore, is as long as Amalek is in the world, you can see God in the past, look in the Torah. You can see God in the future, look in the Navi. You know where it's hard to see God? In the present, in the Hove. So the last two letters of God's name are missing, the Vav He. The Vilna Gaon comments that that's only when there's no Beis HaMikdash. Then Amalek's influence is so strong that it puts doubts in our mind and takes the Aleph off the Kisei and the Vav He out of God's name, as we explained. But when there is a Beis HaMikdash, the miracles that happen in the Beis HaMikdash on a daily basis, and that strong feeling of God's presence in the Mikdash, right, negated and canceled out Amalek's influence. And therefore, those letters, God's throne is complete, and his name is complete. Those letters come back into the world. Where is that hinted to? In the following verse. Ki bochar Hashem b'tzion. God chose Tzion. He chose the Beis HaMikdash. Iva l'moshav lo. He desired it to be the place where he will dwell. That's the sentence. The word Iva is spelled Aleph Vav He. It means to desire. Tava. Iva. He desired. But it's spelled Aleph Vav He. Aleph is the Aleph missing from the Kisei, and Vav He are the two letters missing from God's name. So when the Beis HaMikdash is around, those letters come back into the world. The Aleph, the Vav, and the He are brought back into the world, and God's throne is complete and his name is complete. Because Amalek's influence is negated and canceled out by the influence of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, I want to mention to you a very significant difference between how Amalek looks at us. They're both enemies. The idol worshippers are our enemies most of the time, and the atheists are enemies. But there's a very big difference in how the idol worshippers look at us and how the atheists look at us. What makes the Jewish people great? Two things. One is, Torah says, it's not that we're the strongest, most numerous, smartest, richest people in the world. We're not. We're not. None of those. So what are we? With a nation that has the closest relationship to God in two ways. And the pasuk says it openly. Mi goy gadol asher lo Elohim krovim elav kashem elokeinu b'chol koreinu elav. What great nation has such a close relationship with God that whenever we call him as a nation, he listens to us. So the concept of Klal Yisrael, B'tzibur, the community of Klal Yisrael, has a close relationship with God, and God's always there for us. Even though individuals suffer, individuals died in Mitzrayim, but we celebrate Yetzias Mitzrayim as a nation. Yidden died in Golus Bavel, but we got out of Golus Bavel as a nation. Yidden died in the Holocaust, but we survived the Holocaust as a nation. God always listens to the prayers of the Jewish people throughout history. It's historical fact. We're still around, and other nations had a lot more going for them and are longer here. So our power of prayer and closeness to God is one thing that makes us special. The second thing is, Umi goy gadol, what great nation, asher lo chukim u'mishpatim tzadikim, that have such a just Torah, such a, what's it called, a fit Torah, like the Torah that I'm giving you, all the mitzvahs or whatever that we have, that show that we're special. Because the Torah we have is a very perfect book, and it guides every single aspect of life. That means that every aspect of life is important, of our life is important to God. What we eat and what we think and what we say and what we dress, everything is of universal, eternal importance to God, and therefore He gave us mitzvahs how to do it properly. Because if it wasn't important, who cares how you do it? So that shows a tremendous closeness that we have with God, both in the fact that we have a very, very close relationship through tefillah, through davening, and through the Torah that we keep, which also gives us a very close relationship with God, because God is involved in every single aspect of our life. Those are the two aspects that make us important. Now, if you're an idol worshiper, you have to take into consideration both of these aspects. Because you believe also in gods, you believe in intelligent forces that run the world, and it's possible to get close to those intelligent forces and to manipulate them or to get on their good side. So you have to take into consideration that there's some kind of force, you may not believe it's God, that favors the Jewish people and has kept them around for a long time and saved them from terrible destruction many times. So you may not like it, you may resent it, you may be jealous of it, you may think they don't deserve it, right? You may think that it's some evil force that's doing it, but you have to take in consideration there is such a force, and that there is something special about us. And you also believe in the concept of a Torah, meaning right, wrong, moral, immoral, proper, improper, because you believe that there are intelligent forces that created and guide the world. If there's intelligence, there's purpose. If there's purpose, then there's right and wrong and good and bad and so on. You may distort it completely. You may have right being wrong and wrong being right and good being bad and bad being good, but the concept of good and bad is there. But if you're an atheist, both of these things are not in your lexicon. They don't exist. You can't get close to a God if there is no God. If there are no intelligent powers, what are you getting close to? A hurricane? And there can't be any intrinsic morality in the world, because the world is an accident. And an accident, by definition, is purposeless. And if it's purposeless, then there can't be right, wrong, good, bad. It's all just haphazard, coincidence, accident, happenstance, which can't be attributed good, bad, or anything. Right? If an ant evolved, there's nothing wrong with stepping on the ant. And the mela, right, because an ant is an accident. How can there be anything wrong about stepping on it? And Manela, your aunt from Chicago, also is an accident. She can't be anything wrong with stepping on her either. She's just one gigantic and more of an accident than the aunt, first aunt. So she has less purpose to her. So how can there be anything wrong with murdering somebody? So what does exist in such a world? They do have morality. Situational ethics. Don't step on my toes, because I'll step on your toes. So we have to have rules how to live together. But if I can step on your toes and you can't step back on my toes, then intrinsically there's nothing wrong with stepping on people's toes, because toes are accidental. So that's I think that the Gemara reflects that. The Gemara says, what could Haman be compared to in Achashverosh? When Haman offered Achashverosh 10,000 kikar kesef, talents of silver, for the rights to destroy the Jewish people, Achashverosh said, keep your money and do what you want with the people. And the Gemara says it could be compared to the following. There was a man who had a big mound of earth on his field, and another one had a big ditch. The guy with the ditch was looking for landfill to fill up his ditch. The guy with the mound was looking for somebody to take the mound off his field. And they couldn't find. One day, the guy with the ditch passes by the other guy's field, and he sees this big mound of earth. So he says to him, could you sell me this mound of earth? I could use it to fill up the ditch in my field. And the guy with the mound says, sell it to you. I've been looking for somebody to take it away for free. Just take it. That's Achashverosh and Haman. But what's the difference? To Haman, we were like a ditch. Haman's the Amaleki, the atheist. We're like a nothing. And because we have no importance. Because what makes us important, they don't believe in. And to the idol worshiper, Achashverosh, we're like a big mound. We're something, but something bothers him. Idol worshippers see us as something, but something they don't like. And atheists see us as nothing, and it bothers them that nothing thinks they're something. difference. Now, based on all of this, can explain why Amalek created the philosophy of atheism, why they were the originators of atheism in the world, according to what I'm saying. They had a psychological need for it. Now we will psychoanalyze Amalek. Put him on a couch, and first thing we ask about his parents. Who was your mother? Let's hear a little bit about your mother. His mother's name was Timnah. Timnah hoisa pilegesh le'alifas ben Esav vayivolid lo es Amalek. Timnah was a concubine to Eliphaz, the son of Esav, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz. Now, let's know a little bit about this Timnah and how she got to be a concubine to Eliphaz ben Esav. She was a princess. And she said, I will give up my being a princess so I can marry into the family of Avram Avinu. And as a young woman, she came to Avram and she asked to be converted and to marry into his family. And he rejected her, totally. She came back again as a little bit older woman to Yitzchak, and he rejected her. She came back again as an older woman to Yaakov, and he rejected her. She said, if I can't get into the front door of this family, I will come through the back door and marry the black sheep side of the family. And she said, and it's worth it to be a concubine in this family than to be a princess somewhere else. So she became a concubine to Eliphaz ben Esav. Now probably the Avos rejected her because they saw that she had within her the seeds of Amalek. But the rabbis say they did the wrong thing. They should not have rejected her and pushed her away with two hands. You always pull it close with one hand, with your right hand, and you push away with the left hand. They should have found some accommodation not to push her away completely. And because they did, that's why we suffer from Amalek. Interesting. They weren't makariv her. They pushed her away. Just thought of something. Okay, now, so she ended up marrying Eliphaz because she was rejected by the Avos. Okay. Now Eliphaz, let's see who he was. Okay, Eliphaz was the son of Esav. Esav had the philosophy that might makes right. He lived on this by the sword. Okay, brute strength. And his son Eliphaz was a little bit more sophisticated. He didn't was ascribed to brute strength, but he ascribed to money being the major factor in the world. When he was sent to kill Yaakov, he opted to take his money instead. Okay. Now let's see how that works itself out with being an atheist. If you are rejected by someone, what is the knee-jerk reaction to rejection? Sour grapes. If you rejected me, right, you're going out with somebody and you think they're wow, and then they say no, then you say, oh, that guy was nobody anyway, right? Who wanted him, right? He was like a nobody. Why? Because if he was a somebody, somebody rejected me. But if he's a nobody, nobody rejected me, right? He's a nobody anyway. Who wanted him? So if you were the son of Timnah, who was rejected by the Jewish people, you would have a psychological need to make the Jewish people into nobodies, take away their importance completely. What philosophy fits that perfectly? Atheism. Atheism takes away the importance of the Jewish people completely, like we explained. If your father was Eliphaz, right, atheism says if God doesn't control the world, there's no intelligent forces that control the world, so what does control the world? Power, survival of the fittest. Power, brute strength, money. Your father was Eliphaz, who believed in the fact that it's money that controls the world, and that was his name, Eliphaz. My God is gold. Eliphaz. Mm-hmm. That was his name. So, your father believed that money controlled the world, and your mother was rejected by the Jewish people. The most perfect philosophy to adopt that would combine these two things is atheism. And that's why Amalek became the first atheist. Yes, what was the question?
But why spiritually? I mean, you could have the need to destroy the Jews physically and kill them out. Not spiritually. I don't understand why it would bring atheism into the world.
No, because I want to have a philosophy that makes nothing of these people. Because if I just destroy them, but I consider them something, then something rejected my mother, and that bothers me. Why was she rejected by something? But if I take away all the importance of the Jewish people, they're nothing.
then what was that something?
What? That something was, if I believe in gods, even gods, there's some power, intelligent power, that favors these people. There's something to them. They've survived. But if I attribute it all to just blind chance, then that doesn't make anything special about them. They're lucky. Is there anything special about being lucky? No. But if I believe in gods, even idols, right, then there's something special. Some power thinks they're special. That's the idea. Okay, let's first apply this to Purim. Purim time, we were again weak in our emunah. We were faced with bowing down to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar. And we had a choice. We could get on Nebuchadnezzar's good side or on God's good side. Bowing down would be good in the eyes of Nebuchadnezzar, bad in the eyes of God. Not bowing down would be the opposite. What did we opt to do? Bow down. Why? Because we felt that since God abandoned us, put us into Gaulis, God was no longer involved with us. And now we're in the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar controls the world. And therefore our emunah that God was with us, even in Gaulis, was weak. Therefore we were vulnerable to Haman, to Amalek. And that led to the second sin. The second sin was that we enjoyed the party of Ahasuerus. Not that we went. According to most opinions, they had to go. It was pikuach nefesh. And it wasn't even that they ate there. According to some, it was glatt kosher food. And according to others, even if it wasn't kosher, they had to eat it. You don't say no to Ahasuerus. Vashti tried. Right? And you just don't, what's it called, say, I'm sorry, I can't make it to your party. Right? You don't. You either make it to Ahasuerus' party, or you don't make it to any party. So they had to go. What was the problem? That he enjoyed it. What was Ahasuerus celebrating? The downfall of the Jewish people. Now, how in the world can you go to a party that's celebrating your downfall? Right? That the Beis HaMikdash hasn't been built. Ahasuerus felt the time had come for it to be rebuilt. The Jewish people were totally, abandoned. And that's it. There's not going to be any redemption. And he was celebrating that. And we enjoyed it. You can only enjoy that if you don't have any self-esteem, self-value. You're a Jew hater of yourself. You hate yourself. And that was a natural result. If we're not sure that God's involved with us, then we have no greatness. Our only greatness is that God's involved with us. And the less God is involved with us, the less important we are. And if you don't think you're important, then how do you get importance? By rubbing shoulders with great people like Ahasuerus. And there's people today just like that. People shook the hand of Arafat and run to be Menachem Avil by murderers of our children. Because they have no self-esteem as Jews. Their whole self-esteem is by being around powerful people, even murderers of our own people. So that was the double sin. And therefore, we were vulnerable to Haman. And he made a point of his atheism. And he said, there's no hashgacha, there's nothing intelligent in this world. It's all a lot. It's all the throw of a lot. And that's what he said. Poor, hu agorav. Your goral, your destiny, is just the throw of a lot. There's no God. There's no intelligent forces. Whoever has the power runs the world. I have the power. And I'll destroy you. Totally. That was what Haman represented. What was the kapara when we realized two things? One is we realized that God is involved, even in Gaulis, and we cried out to him. And secondly, we regained our self-esteem. We're important people. So Purim, basically, we celebrate both of those aspects. We celebrate the fact that God is always there, even when he's in the background, but he's there, behind the scenes. And that is the mitzvah of reading the Megillah. The Megillah shows us that even in normal situations, seemingly natural occurrences, God's hand is behind everything. Because the Megillah is too much to be a coincidence. There's too many things there. It's set up in such a way you see clearly God's hand behind the scenes. That's Megillah Esther. And the other mitzvahs represent that we're important. If God is there, and he's involved in everything about us, even in Gaulis, then we're pretty important. Because in God's plan, we are very important. And therefore, if you consider yourself important, you want to promote yourself. How do you do that? Eat. So we have a Suda. 8. There should be more of me because I'm an important person in God's eyes. In fact, just the opposite. Anorexia usually is attributed with a death wish, with a feeling of no self-esteem and I'm not really fit to be around and therefore I want to disappear. So eating, that doesn't mean somebody who overeats is has a lot of self-esteem or whatever, but in any case it goes together somewhat within certain limitations. And then there is what's it called, the idea that I'm not important because I'm me, I'm important because I'm a Jew, so give other Jews to eat. That's Mishloach Manos. Give them something to eat. And we're not important because of things we have. We're important because we're Jewish, and if we have nothing besides that, we'd be important. Give to the Ani who has nothing except the fact that he's a Jew. And don't give him tzedakah. Give him a present, because he's important. You give presents to important people. So you give a present to the poor, not tzedakah to the poor. Well, it's not a nebuch. You're an important person. Why do I give you a present? And that is the simcha of Purim. The simcha is that God is always there. That's a simcha of feeling a certain amount of bitachon, of serenity and security, and also feeling good about yourself. That's the ultimate simcha. Now the Rambam says that the basic message of Purim is that sentence that we mentioned, Mi goy gadol asher lo Elohim krovim elav kashem elokeinu b'chol kareinu elav. Who is such a great nation like we are that have a God so close to them that when they call to him as a nation, he answers. That's what Purim tells us. We called to God as a nation and he answered us and he saved us from Haman. And we survived. And here's a case where we survived totally, not just partially, not just the nation survived, every individual survived. See, the ultimate. Because other situations, the nation survived, but individuals suffered from Mitzrayim on. But here, everybody survived. The entire nation and all the individuals. Something very special. And the Mela, that brought us to an appreciation of Torah, because we got close to God. We recognize our closeness to God through tefillah, and the Nela, our closeness to God and the fact that he gave us a Torah and he's involved in everything in our life. And that Torah is a just Torah and we get rewarded if we keep it and punished, and there's reward and punishment because everything is not haphazard, followed in suit. So once we felt that closeness to God through tefillah, automatically we accepted the Torah willingly. When it came to Matan Torah, God brought us closer against our will even. He came down to us. But on Purim, we came back to him willingly. So Torah and Tefillah are both aspects of what's it called, of Purim. And that's why in this week's Sedra, the idea of sacrifices, which is the counterpart of Tefillah, Avoda. Avoda means coming closer to God. Adam ki yakriv mikem korban. You want to get closer to God. You want to feel that closeness. You want to feel that God is involved in every single thing in your life. And by bringing a sacrifice, that's how you do it. Right? You totally negate yourself to God. That's what a sacrifice is. And you become more and more like God so you can become one with him. And get as close as you can to him. Because the more you're like him, the more you can become close to him. And therefore, it says, Adam ki akri mikem. Adam means you're like God. God himself is called Adam, like sitting on a throne. Adam yoshev ala kisei to the Nevi'im. So we are like God when we're Adam. Adam means you're taken from the Adama, you're taken from the earth, but you're like the earth that you can now give things growth. You're like a fertile place for growth of other things. That's just like God. God is one who gives growth to everything, gives existence to everything. And you were created in God's image, and you also can give growth and existence to other things. That's why you're Adam. You're Adam from the Adama, and you're Adameh. You can be like God in that respect. You give to others. And therefore, Adam negates stealing, because the opposite concept. You're like God in that you take whatever you have and give to others, not you take what others have. God doesn't take from anybody. Everything's his. So in order to be Adam, you have to be somebody who doesn't steal. And if you bring a carbon and stealing, it's an unbelievable contradiction. If you want to get close to God, and you're doing it in a way that makes you completely different than God by stealing. Therefore, it says, "Sone gezel ba'ola." God hates stealing when it comes to sacrifices, because it's the total antithesis of what a sacrifice is. So then, you're not coming close to God by a sacrifice. You're trying to manipulate God, make him change his mind. That's why you bring. You're trying to get on his good side or whatever. It's not that you become one with God and then God takes care of you. But you're trying, you know, to be a separate from God and try to convince him to do whatever. Then you become the manipulator of God. That's why a behemoth also came from the earth. But a behemoth is bama, whatever it has, it has. It's the idea of the soil having in it what its composition is, legabe the soil. The animal is considered soil separated from the ground. A clump of earth, that's an animal. Whatever's there is there, nothing's going to come from it. A man is considered connected to the ground, so he can grow things in it. He's what's there has the ability to make other things grow, to take what he has and make growth and make himself grow and perfect and become like God. And therefore, a person, it says, who pulls his ears away from listening to Torah, his davening is a toeva. His davening is an abomination. Because the whole idea of Torah is also to feel that closeness to God. That God directs every aspect of your life. And everything you do either makes you closer to God or farther away. And learning Torah brings you closer to God's mind. So if you stop learning, right, then your davening is a toeva, because then you don't want to be closer to God. Davening is an avoda. I want to get close to God, and then God will take care of my needs, because I'm completely buckled him. I'm his eved. An adam takes care of his eved's needs because it's his best interest. But if I'm not close to God, then what am I doing when I daven? I'm manipulating God. I'm begging him, trying to make him change his mind. That's already a toeva. That's a disgusting thing. Right? You're manipulating God. You want God to take care of you and take care of your needs because you're his eved, because you're buckled to him, not because you're an adversary and you're arguing with God, you know, maybe do this for me, do that for me or whatever, and trying to manipulate God. That's called a toeva.
Well, toeva is to manipulate?
What? That's why what?
Toeva
is an abomination. And that's why Purim is a yontif. We read the Megillah, it says night and day. Why? Because we cried out to God night and day. So the reading of Megillah is like davening. It's like Hallel. It's like getting that closeness to God through davening, and also it's Torah. Because we receive the Torah willingly. So the Megillah represents both that, but our being able to reach out to God in Tefillah is as a tzibur, as a community. So it has to do with Achdus. So we send Mishloach Manos one to the other. And just like the Oni looks to the rich person to be mashpia on him and to help him out, right? We are then acting like God. We are getting close to God by giving to the Ani. And Mamela, we look to God like the Ani looks to us. So we give Matanus Levyonim. Also the same idea. And the Suda is also this idea of I want to take all my physical being and totally negate it to God. I'm eating l'shem shamayim. I'm eating because I'm God's servant and I want to be able to serve God in a better way. Right? I'll be able to, what's it called, to serve the Rabban Shalom in a better way. There's a story, I don't know why it just came into my mind now, wasn't planning to speak about it, but the story of, what's it called, of a guy who was a glutton. He used to eat and eat. He was a tremendously big guy. And people look down on him, what's it called, you know, he's a glutton or whatever, Jew. And somebody once asked him why he's doing this. He said, because when the Cossacks came and they took away my father, he was a frail man or whatever, and they took him away and they killed him, you know, on the spot, and he didn't have a really chance from a Kaddishim Shemayim. So when they come to get me, it's going to take them a long time to drag me away, and I'm going to have a time to do this, what's it called, in Mekadoshim Shamayim, in the proper way. So sometimes you can eat and fresh, but you're doing it L'shem Shamayim. You're doing it because I want to be God's servant, and the more of me, like a soldier, is wants to be healthy so he can serve his country better. So that's what it means, what's it called, Sudas Purim. The, okay, those are just some... some new ideas. I'd just like to throw out an idea to you that I was just thinking about. I don't know how it works out 100%, but then the holiday is called Purim. Two Purs. Right? Purim, not Pur. Why? So I was thinking, it could be that simple, that Haman made two lots, miyom liyom, day to day, and mechodesh lechodesh, month to month. Okay? Now, if you think about it, day to day is the sun. That's what makes a day. Month to month is the moon. So Haman wanted to show that there's no hashgacha, no, not from a sun standpoint, not from the natural standpoint, and not from the supernatural standpoint, which is the months, the lunar year. Therefore, we have 2 days of Purim. One that goes after the days of the month, the 14th day, because there's nothing significant on the 14th day, Lagabi, the moon. But the 15th day, you can tell by the moon. It's the middle of the month. So you don't need days to know when it's the 15th. Just look at the moon, you'll know for sure it's the 15th of the month, it's a full moon. So we celebrate Purim. We negate both of Haman's Purs. Not only is God involved in the natural world, he's involved also in the supernatural world. Not in the sun world, but also in the moon world. And Shushan Purim, the Purim Yerushalayim, is more the moon, God involved in the spiritual workings of the world. And the first day Purim is more God is involved in the physical, natural things. And it fits very nicely, because the people outside of Shushan, not in walled cities, were more naturally vulnerable. The ones in the walled cities weren't naturally vulnerable. There would have to be something specifically against them, a more spiritual danger that they were in, not a physical danger, because physically they were protected. So one represents saving from a physical danger, that God's involved in the natural world, and the other one from more spiritual danger, God's involved in the spiritual world. And that's why it's called Purim, the Pur Miyom Liyom, and the Pur Mechodesh Lechodesh.